Okay, what I'd like to talk to you about is really this, I think, very exciting nexus that we have now between the observations as they're starting to come in on looking for planets and all the things associated with planetary systems, and the theory that we're going to need to explain all of this. And I think a conference like this is really a critical thing to bring together the observers and the theoreticians. And in the next decade, I think what's important to realize is there's an enormous amount of observational information that's going to start to come in. I mean, right now we know a little bit. In a decade we've learned something about the presence of gas giant planets within about 3 AU of parent stars, solar type stars. And that's a nice little keyhole into what planetary systems are like, but it's only going to be a part of the story. But in the next decade, we're really going to flesh this out enormously. We're going to find out a lot about Kuiper belts and even asteroid belts around all sorts of stars. We're going to get a lot more information on the primordial gas and the remnant dust as the evolution gets, as the evolution of the planetary system goes from being a protoplanetary, protostellar disk into these remnant gas disks with planets. Our observational capabilities will take us from gas giant planets down to the smaller rocky planets, and then ultimately we'll go from having information about barren worlds, gas giants presumably, to looking for actual evidence for life itself. And it's really this network of theory building alongside the observational data. Both of those have to progress together, and we can then really knit these disparate facts that the observers will have through, basic physical laws plus chaotic initial conditions to learn a lot more about the evolution of planetary systems and all their constituent parts, and ultimately get to some idea of what the incidence of life might be in other systems. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the life part, since I think this is really a focused effort on really trying to understand planetary systems with the group that we have here. So I'll jump into some of the observational opportunities that we have, either ongoing or in the near future, sort of the next decade, and basically take you from what's happening right now with Spitzer through some of the space-based and a couple of the ground-based opportunities. So we jump right into the whole question of disks, which is really a signpost that we can't yet interpret for the presence of planets. I mean, disks are either showing their planets are there, not there, but it does tell us that there is a lot of solid material to work with. And even though we started out as a mid-IR technique with IRAS or FAR-IR, a lot of the more recent information on disks has really come from the coronagraphs, either ground-based or with Hubble or eventually JWST, or in the submillimeter from JCMT, because that gives you, those instruments give you the highest angular resolution on the brightest disks. And that's really revealed quite a lot of information about the structure, the amount of material, eventually perhaps composition. But you can see here this most recent coronagraphic result just in the last couple of weeks in nearby M star, sort of a 200 AU system. Here's an HST image over here, again solar system scale, and here's a submillimeter JCMT image. And the thing that you see in a lot of these cases is there's some sort of hole in the distribution near the center of the star, and then potentially clumps around here, indicative perhaps of the presence of some sort of internal, possibly a planet, possibly multiple planets, that produce this sort of clumping. So among the theoretical needs that we have is to understand better what's the dynamical evolution of the structure, how does the amount of material, at least in square centimeters of emitting material, change as a function of time, both through migration processes, collision processes, radiation effects, and so on. What sort of compositional gradients might we expect? A major contribution to all of this will be the Spitzer telescope, which is going to spend a lot of its time focused on the whole question of disks around nearby stars. And I'll talk about a couple of these results. For people who are really interested in the sociology of science, it is 25 years or so, a little bit longer, since Spitzer actually started. So as you know, people start thinking about TPF or some of these more distant missions, you should recognize it'll be a while. And it is built on people. I just wanted to mention Mike Warner, who gave me a couple of the Spitzer slides that I'm going to use here. But it's really through the efforts of people like Mike and sort of a small group of scientists that we actually have Spitzer in orbit. This is August of last year, and we're just now starting to see some of the first results, and it'll actually be another couple of months before enough data really accumulate that there'll be an issue of APJ letters. It'll have a big slug of data, and then over the coming months and years there'll just be lots and lots of material, both on disks, brown dwarfs, and so on. So that's going to give you a bit of the flavor of what the Spitzer results are going to be like. Hopefully some of you in here also put in proposals yourself, so you'll be getting some of this data in the near future. So this is just an optical image that phase into an infrared Spitzer image of an embedded outflow in an HH object, and you can see clearly here an obscured region with just a little hint of an HH object. Look in the infrared and you see the whole thing revealed to you. Same sort of thing, another star forming region with an optical image that then you start to be able to see through the cloud and see some of the embedded sources. In this IRAC image, the previous image and this one are both made at 3 to 8 microns, combining the light from a couple of the different filters in the IRAC camera. In addition to just taking pretty pictures, there's a spectrometer on board, and you can start to see both at low resolution and at high resolution lots of different spectral features from PAHs and other species in reflection nebulae, and then obviously many, many objects as well. So we'll get both very sensitive imaging and very good spectroscopy, low-resolution spectroscopy, to start addressing questions like at least the gross compositional information in everything from protostars and disks to very distant galaxies. The thing to remember about Spitzer, it's basically very good for looking at bright lines in faint objects. The ISO satellite was good for looking at very faint lines and very bright objects. So you don't have a lot of resolution to play with, but you'll be able to do a lot of work on the gross mineralogy of disks. For people here who are interested in the spectra of brown dwarfs, T-dwarfs, and eventually predicting what might be going on with planets, the IRIS guys have also looked at, Tom Rolling up at Ames produced the spectrum of a T-dwarf companion to Epsilon Indi, and you can see that there's still some work to be done, so people should get busy. But on the other hand, you know, this very large feature that's predicted for the brown dwarfs up around 5 microns certainly does appear to be there. So I think there's a lot of things that we'll see that get us into the spectroscopy and the physical conditions, at least of the brown dwarfs. And then to the extent that one can nail down those observations properly, one has some hope of pushing down more into the realm of giant planets. It'll be a number of years before we actually have spectra of giant planets at this level of sensitivity, but it's certainly a long-term goal. If you think about the goals of TPF, one of the things it will have to do is it will have the sensitivity and the angular resolution to isolate a giant planet from its parent star and get a spectrum something like this. So come back to observations of disks themselves. There's probably 20 programs on Spitzer, particularly once we get the guaranteed the general observer time proposals that have just been submitted. Some fraction of those will get selected. I think there were 40 proposals to do something with disks in the open time proposals that that builds on probably a half dozen different programs within the guaranteed time, and the legacy team selected a couple of years ago. Spitzer is angular resolution challenged. It's an 85 centimeter telescope, so it has lousy resolution, but it has enormous sensitivity, surface brightness sensitivity, that lets it get down to, as I'll show, something like a few times the optical depth that we think is there in our own Kuiper belt, so, and maybe even down into that regime. So the sorts of projects that Spitzer is already undertaking, and that'll be enhanced by the General Observer programs when they come in, is to map, survey, and take spectra of disks around really hundreds of stars of all different types. You know, single stars, binary stars of various separations, spectral types and ages, everything from A stars down to M stars, even a couple of L and T dwarfs are being studied for disks. There's obviously a lot of emphasis on looking at the effect of planets on disks, other stars with and without planets, or at least without known planets. Question of metallicity is certainly being probed. And then ages spanning a whole arena from really going from protostellar kinds of disks all the way out to, you know, 5 billion year old quite mature stars. And the sorts of questions that one will try and get from the, in addition to just the basic incidence of disks around various types of stars, learn things about the emitting grains. How large are they? Is there a sense of that the size of the grains or their composition varies with time? These are all the sorts of questions that we'll be able to address. And remember, to a great extent, this is defined as a far infrared kind of problem, just because the sensitivity you need to make real progress is hasn't been there. In the short wavelengths, it's very hard to see the disks against the bright, bright star. By the time you get into the submillimeter, the disks are just very faint for ground-based telescopes to see through. ISO did some of this work, but really had a sensitivity problem in the mid and far IR. And so CERTIF is really our best shot at studying these disks since the phenomenon was really discovered with IRAS. So I think there'll be a lot happening in this region. Again, just another brief taste of what Spitzer data would show. Here's a young cluster. Here's a JHK ground-based color diagram, giants, dwarfs, and the reddening line. And there are a few sources in here with some excesses that might have disks. If instead of looking at the K-band, you go J minus H, H minus Spitzer, 5 microns, all of a sudden you see an enormous range of disks that start to become apparent that just weren't there, and for the material, presumably the material has gone away from this system, which is a few million years old. The material in close to these stars is either not there, it's not getting heated, but presumably it's not there. Go up to 5 microns, where you're now looking at 500, 600 degree material, a few AU away from the star, not right in close to the star, is required to produce an excess at 2 microns, and you start seeing lots of stars with disks on this level. So we'll have this to pin down the evolution of disks from the first few million years all the way out to giga years. So the evolution is going to be a very important part of this.
Does that mean all existing constraints, observational constraints, age of, or the time scale for gas depletion or dust depletion should really be taken with a large grain of salt?
That's always true. I think what this is showing is two things. People have used either K or L band from the ground to get some idea of at least where the dust is. And to the extent that you think the dust is a good tracer of what the gas is doing, then you have to take it for a grain of salt. I think as you get to older and older disks, which you're going to see presumably at longer and longer wavelengths, there is a decoupling with the gas. So I think you still have to, as a function of time, understand how your long wavelength dust indicator is still telling you about a system that has a mixture of gas and dust. I think eventually as you get into the debris disks, the gas is gone. But once you establish that, gee, at 3 microns where you've got a lot of material at a few AU, and then you say, okay, in enough of these cases there is a good mixture of gas and dust, then you could use this 3 or 5 micron indicator to tell you what's going on. But I think you're still going to want to, in the end, get some sort of gas indicator as well to correlate with this.
As far as the dust goes,
yeah,
there's still dust at a few AU, there's not dust really close in. Is the optical depth such that it's convincing that a larger fraction of the dust close in was removed relative to outside? Was it a very high optical depth outside, low optical depth inside, and cut it down by a factor of 10, and still see what's outside almost as strong, and then see what's inside?
Let's see. I mean, it's certainly going to be the case that, I mean, the star here that has, a K excess is certainly going to have a strong, 5 micron excess. And there's going to be a lot of material in close, and then that has at some level been eaten away, and I think there's probably an actual gap. Now, the danger by the time you get into 1 to 2 microns is you actually have to take into account all the scattering effects that are going to happen at 2 microns. So there's an extra way to get the light out that you really have to do the radiative transfer, because the dust could be a quite effective scatterer at the short wavelengths. So I think it's not an easy answer to your question. But I think what the models wind up showing is you get this peeling apart of the disk that just as time progresses, there's just less and less material inside 1, 2, 3, 5 AU. Okay, so here is now moving into the more diffuse disks. This is the disk around Fomalhaut. It's a well-known IRAS source, of course, one of the bright FAM4, but it's also one of the ones that Spitzer can hope to resolve. So here's a 70 micron image, a 24 micron image, you put them together, and you have something that you can then compare to the 450 micron JCMT image. And the sorts of things we're looking at as we start to examine the data carefully is it certainly looks as though the 24 micron data is interior to the 70 micron cloud. So there is a distribution of presumably smaller grains that is filling the cavity at 70 microns, and that shows up at 70 microns. And that's been seen before in objects like Beta Pic, where there's bigger grains further out, and then a lower optical depth component closer in that's seen at the shorter wavelengths. This is just another rendition of that with 70 micron in color, 24 microns in contours. You can certainly see an asymmetry here. I'll discuss the origin of that on the next slide. And I just wanted to show on this plot here, it gives you an idea of what sort of sensitivity we will have to these various dust disks. So this is just a commonly used ratio of the luminosity in the dust relative to that of the star. Our solar system is in this range here, 10 to the minus 6, couple 10 to the minus 7, and sort of the asteroid belt is around in here, sort of optical depths of a couple 10 to the minus 7. Predictions of our Kuiper belt are out in here. And then these lines, the dashed lines, show what different degrees of sensitivity at 24 microns would let you observe, and here's what you could see at 70 microns for observations with different amounts of sensitivity. And the ratios go from about 10% photometric accuracy, 40%, or a factor of 2. And if we could achieve total photometric accuracy, which includes calibration effects and the ability to subtract out a photospheric model, which is very important, then we'll be in the range where, in the asteroid belt, we're a couple of orders of magnitude away from being able to detect our own asteroid belt around another star, just because we're making this measurement in a purely photometric sense. You're looking at an excess over a photosphere, and the photosphere is very bright, even at 24 microns. So that's a pretty large jump. At 70 microns, however, the photosphere has dropped a lot, the dust is coming up, and in this range here, we're sitting in an area where we're within a factor of a couple, maybe 10, of the level of emission in our own Kuiper belt. So I think we have a chance, particularly at the longer wavelengths, to get down to levels of emission that accompany a very mature star like our own. It'll be the more exceptional case where we can get stuff in right in the sort of the equivalent of the asteroid belt, a few AU, of our own system. So the kinds of things we can deduce, oh, here's just one more, just to whet your appetite. Beta Pic, of course, is the most famous of these stars. It's got a well-observed disk at visible wavelengths, and you can start to see how it shows up at around 20 microns in the pickup camera in the IRS spectrometer. Here's an on-orbit point source compared to a theoretical model. Diffraction theory works, and that's not our main result, but this is, you know, the disk here without any deconvolution, without a lot of co-adding. But you can clearly see we're resolving this disk, and there's a whole lot of information we're gaining spectroscopically and from an imaging standpoint on Beta Pic itself. The kind of theory work that needs to get done is to try and understand what is the origins of the asymmetries that we're actually seeing. A number of people have worked on this. A postdoc at the JPL, Beth Holmes, has been working specifically on the Spitzer data for Fomalhaut and is working on a theory to have the perturbations of a putative planet see if you can produce a shift in the position of the Kuiper belt due to forced eccentricity and forced pericenters of the dust particles as you move out past the planet out into the Kuiper belt. And what happens is you actually shift the center of the Kuiper belt away from the star itself, so it's not symmetric around the star. In fact, the dust distribution peaks closer to the star on one side as opposed to the other, and at short wavelengths, the fact that the dust is a little bit closer generates quite a lot more emission at 24 microns, and that because you're on the wean side of the black body curve. At longer wavelengths, that effect decreases, and you would get less and less asymmetry as you go to longer and longer wavelengths. And in fact, that appears to be what we're seeing, at least in this initial reduction of the Fomalhaut disk. As you go from 24 microns, the asymmetry is quite large. 70 microns and 160 microns is progressively less. And then by the time you get out another submillimeter, what you basically have is a fairly uniform distribution of dust density. And so you just see fairly slight variations due to the heating at the very long wavelengths where you're on the Rayleigh-Jeans side of the tail. So you can start to reproduce some of the observations that we're seeing even in these very early Spitzer data. But this is clearly going to be an area where a lot of theoretical work is required. One of the things we want to investigate then is this influence of planets on the disks that may exist around these stars. So one of the samples is one that I'm involved in. We're doing really a volume-limited survey of stars and trying to highlight, and at least a part of that sample, those objects with planets. And you can see from the standpoint of planets with different semi-major axes, different eccentricities. Here's the entire sample with the blue dots, and the size is proportional to the mass of the planet. And you can see we've picked out a variety of objects to observe with Spitzer, which are the purple dots. And particularly for planets where they're located beyond a few AU, 2, 3, 5 AU, that presumably will start to stir up the material in a way that we can detect as perturbations on the properties of a disk. You know, a planet that's in at a tenth of an AU is unlikely to produce a lot of changes in dust out at 5 and 10 AU, which is where we start to become sensitive to the dust material in a disk. So what do we do on disks beyond Spitzer? Well, the real key is going to be angular resolution in the mid and far infrared. This is a model of what Vega might look like at 24 microns with Spitzer, and you can see we can start to resolve some asymmetries in the disk, but what you'd really like to do is observe that with a lot better spatial resolution. This is the same system observed with JWST, the 10 micron instrument there, the mirror instrument, and you can make clearly a much better image if you go from an 85 centimeter telescope up to a 6 meter telescope. So that's clearly a long-term goal, and you can actually even do spectroscopy on some of these blobs separately with JWST. In the interim, another thing we'll be able to do is work with ground-based interferometers to get rid of the starlight, not by looking at a photosphere and subtracting it out, but actually nulling out the star. So the figure at the top indicates what a star plus disk system would look like. The very sharp null here at the center is a result of doing a null of the star on the 85 meter baseline between the two keks, and then you see in blue the fringe response of the interferometer pair of telescopes, and you basically get to look at all the light from the disk that filters through in the through the positive parts of the fringe response and be able to get some information on how much dust is there without the influence of the star itself on the observations. So Keck has one particular spatial response that peaks up around a few tenths of an AU for a star at 10 parsecs. The Arizona Large Binocular Telescope with a 14 meter baseline will have a response that peaks closer to a half to one AU. The Genie instrument on the VLTI has like a 100 meter baseline. So between these different baselines, we'll also get an idea on what the zodiacal dust emission is on the spatial scale of a few tenths up to a few AU. Combining that information with sort of Spitzer observations for the zero spacings, if you will, and then maybe JWST for a higher resolution filled aperture, we'll start to get a pretty good idea of what the distribution of material is in something that corresponds not to the Kuiper belts, but to the asteroid belts of this system. And the sensitivities we're looking at, certainly with the Keck interferometer, is going to be on the range of something like 10 times the amount of emission in our own asteroid belt, or in our internal Zodi cloud. So, I mean, that's quite encouraging. It's still a couple of years away, but the Keck interferometer nuller should actually be taking its first fringes later this summer. Okay, so that's disks. We can clearly then come to this question of how common are planets themselves. That'll be obviously the focus of a lot of discussion at this conference. I guess Deborah's giving a talk tomorrow, so I won't presume to give any detail on that. But we're talking about now over 115 gas giant planets. I think Deborah would say that the number of stars for which they have a very long temporal baseline with reasonable sensitivity, you know, goes back to the original Lick sample. And for that, the fraction with planets is something like 10 to 15% within 3 AU. That's the best sample from which to derive a complete, reliable estimate of the fraction of stars with planets. They have a much larger sample, but they started them later, and they really note the importance of having a long time baseline to make definitive statements. So the number I carry around is of order 10 to 15% of mature FGK stars have planets, gas giant planets, within about 3 AU. Of those, half of them may be multiple systems, And we're just starting to identify planets on longer periods. So here's 55 Cancri. It actually has a Jupiter in close to the right place as far as having a habitable zone inside, an AU or so. We don't really know what's going on in this region here in 55 Cancri. We do have the problem of two Jupiter mass planets inside the orbit of Mercury. So you could imagine an exciting transition phase if you were an Earth sitting here as these planets pass through. And maybe, of course, this is a system where there are no Earths that are possible to have. And we'll find out as we start to get more data on these systems. An important coming opportunity will be to use astrometry, position wobbles of these stars, in addition to radial velocity, and use that to determine solar system architectures down to a few times the mass of the Earth, at least for the closest stars. Let's see, I'll come back to astrometry in a minute. Clearly the transit technique is proving to be very exciting, at least for systems where we know we have an edge on planets. So for HD 209458, the very first transit result provided really a remarkable confirmation of the radial velocity data. I mean, I use this in sort of popular talks to highlight how science works. So here you have one whole observational thrust of radial velocity, complicated big telescopes, and so on, but it made a very specific prediction, sufficiently precise that the people in Colorado were able to take about a 10-inch telescope, go to their parking lot, and at just the right time, down to a few seconds, see a little 1% blip due to a transit of the planet in front of the parent star. And from that you get a whole lot of physical information, the radius of the system, its density. You can tell a lot about how the planet formed by the size and so on. So there's a lot of physics that starts to get done when you add the transit information to the RV information. Instead of a few tenths of a percent accuracy from the ground, obviously that you can go up into Hubble and get down to something like 10 to the minus fifth accuracy from space. And from that you start to actually be able to look at the size of the planet in different spectral lines. And the spectroscopy has already shown quite remarkably the presence of hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen, essentially boiling off the atmosphere of the planet and revealing something about the actual atmosphere of one of these planets beyond our solar system. And in the long term, there's obviously a promise of taking data like what we've seen for 209458 and using it to interpret a lot about clouds, cloud heights, heavy metal abundances, structures in the atmosphere of the planet itself. On the other hand, there's really only one or two of these systems found to date. There's another one found out of the Ogle consortium, but it's been pretty hard to identify these systems, but there are a lot of ground-based searches just starting, we hope, to bear fruit. So we'll find some more of these. I think the next exciting step will really come with a combination of the Corot and Kepler missions, which will monitor tens of thousands to 100,000 stars within about a kiloparsec. Depending on what you think the incidence of Earths are, you get something between 50 and a few hundred, what we might call rocky planets, with radii in the range of 1 to 2 Earth radii. They'll also see lots of giant planets, sort of short period ones, and from increases in the reflected light, increases in the brightness of the star due to reflected light from the planet as it goes at quadrature, you'll actually be able to pick up what the albedos of those planets are as well. I should also mention one other telescope here, which is the MOST telescope. It's a very small telescope that the Canadian Space Agency launched that will look at a few dozen of very bright stars instead of 10 to the fourth or 10 to the fifth, but with the accuracy that these systems will have. The Canadians call it the Hubble Space Telescope, but it really does have the sensitivity to work at micromagnitudes. So as Doug and I were discussing earlier, if there are hot Earths then there's the possibility that they'd be able to see little blips, you know, that repeat very, that are a repetitive thing many times, you know, in the couple of months that they look at a given star, and that would be a first hint that there might be rocky planets there. I think most likely Corot and Kepler will be the observing systems that will look at enough stars to get at some reliable statistics on transiting planets. Okay, so astrometry, coming back to that, as you know, the position of a star changes as the planet tugs it around in its orbit. The radial velocity guys measure the motion in and out of the plane of the sky. Astrometry makes the measurement in the plane of the sky, and this is what the Earth system would look like as seen from 10 parsecs looking down on the ecliptic plane. This is a milliarcsecond, and most of the large motions are due to Jupiter and Saturn. The little jaggedy lines here are actually due to the printer, but they're also roughly the scale of what an Earth would look like in terms of the influence of the Earth on the position of the Sun. And with interferometry, we'll be able to make measurements at the microarcsecond level. And just to tell you what a microarcsecond is, if you were looking at the Mars rovers from Earth and they were flicking the headlights on and off, you could tell which was the right headlight and the left headlight, which is roughly sort of the microarcsecond observation. So the ambition for the Space Interferometer mission is to complete a census of planets down to a few Earth masses for a couple of hundred stars, and in fact a slightly less sensitive but broader survey for a few thousand stars. So the sorts of things SIM will address are really our areas of ignorance right now. Our planetary systems like our own, Jupiter's on the outside, smaller planets on the inside, common. What's the distribution of planetary masses as a function of any of your favorite variables? And I should point out that it's really only astrometry that can measure a planet mass unambiguously with no sign inclination effect, for example. And are there low mass planets in the habitable zones of nearby stars? So there'll be a broad survey of planets, 2,000 stars within about 25 parsecs, for which a 4 microarcsecond accuracy is expected, and that's more than enough to give you essentially Uranus a limit. So this is really a survey for gas giants and maybe the largest rocky planets. There'll also be a much more detailed survey of perhaps a few hundred stars, really focusing down on the questions, are there 1, 2, 3 Earth mass systems around the nearest F, G, and K stars, M stars, and you get down to 3 Earth masses at about 10 parsecs. And then project that I'm involved with is what is the evolution of planetary systems, and given that the astrometric angle decreases with distance, and the nearest star, young stars, are 50 to 150 parsecs away, we can't do anything with Earth-like systems, but we can look at the evolution of gas giants and Jupiters and actually try and detect Jupiters around the nearest young stars and determine from that where those planets might form and how over the first 10 to 1 to 50 million years the distribution of Jupiter-like systems changes as a function of time. Another technique that is promising is microlensing, where the presence of a planet around the lensing star affects the properties of the lens itself, and that produces a fairly large photometric signal that can last a few hours to a few days. So here's your standard microlensing curve. The large curve extends over many, many months of amplification of factors of 2, 5, or 10. A little planet might produce a small blip, maybe not as large as what you have here, but certainly a 5 or 10% photometric effect. Quite easy to detect compared to the transit signal, which of course is a few parts per million. So that's quite an exciting possibility there, if you can track a microlensing system for a long period of time. Essentially, you don't know where that blip's going to come, so you have to be able to monitor this system pretty much continuously for the entire duration of the microlensing event. There are a number of ground-based programs going on that may bear fruit, and then there's a space mission that's at least been proposed that could discover essentially hundreds of planets from Jupiter's to Earth's, and there are a number of candidate microlensing events that might be due to a Jupiter or a binary of Jupiter. This is still yet to really prove itself, but I think there's some initial indications of some promising results. A disadvantage of microlensing is the typical lensing stars are 4 to 8 kiloparsecs away as you look towards the bulge of the galaxy, and in many cases they'll be of an unknown spectral type, but presumably they're the most common sorts of stars, so you're mostly looking at M dwarfs or even L dwarfs. So you're not necessarily looking at the right kind of stars, you know, for understanding the formation of Earths around solar type stars, but it would certainly be a new observational window onto the frequency of planets if you could get a large-scale program underway. Okay, so we put all these things together. This is a pretty standard plot that this tries to summarize in terms of the companion mass and the semi-major axis, the power of different techniques, the different selection biases. Here's a radial velocity curve, this blue curve here, at 3 meters per second. These dots are all the different planets known as of the week this particular plot was made. And you see we're not really down yet taking advantage of the full sensitivity at 3 meters per second. And that's just because it takes a significant amount of time to accumulate enough data. And probably the limit of these early data from Jeff and Deborah is more like a 10 meter per second average accuracy. You can see that the astrometry comes in a complementary way. This red curve here is SIM with a 5-year mission at 3 microarc seconds, or SIM 5-year mission and 1 microarc second, and you're starting here to push into then Earth-like sensitivities. The transit experiments do a very good job on systems that are in close because you get multiple events to look at, and they will also go out to an order 1AU, at least for Kepler, which has a 4-year mission lifetime. Let's see, and here's one of the, this purple line is one of the microlensing ground-based experiments. So there's going to be a lot of different ways that we attack filling in this mass semi-major axis plane. And yeah, we're up here now, and we clearly want to get in the end of the next decade down into this range here, and there are a number of observational programs that should let us do this. So that's the observational side. Clearly the theory side has to explain that same plot, or even, dare I say, make a prediction or two about what that plot would look like. And the sort of hints the theoreticians will get will be plots like this, where we have what is the fraction of stars with planets, how does it evolve or change with metallicity. This is some of the early, the more recent work by Deborah Fisher and her collaborators, where they try and bin up the fraction of stars with planets as a function of the metallicity they derive from their data. This plot here, that I'm sure Doug will tell us more about, gives you an idea of where planets of different kinds would form. So you have terrestrial planets in this range, the gas giants, ice giants, hot Jupiters, which have migrated in. What we'd like to have is essentially not dots that come out of computer programs, but dots that come out of the observational programs. And if you look at what we'll complete by the, you know, the next decade or so, you know, basically filling in this plane, we should be able to make some match up with theory, by which time Doug will have gone on to a new theory. But you know, we'll remember this. It's going to be online, Doug. And I think one thing that's important to note is what is this fraction?
Your time is up.
You know, so what is the fraction of systems with Earths? Is it a number like a tenth? That number certainly helps to determine the scope of a mission like TPF. How many stars do you have to look at? So I'll just talk very briefly about TPF. It's hard. It's hard for a couple of reasons. There are not too many stars you can look at. The sensitivity is probably the easiest part. You can detect a 30th magnitude thing in a couple of hours if you have 10 or 15 square meters of collecting area, either in the infrared or in the visible. So the fact you're only getting, you know, a few photons per meter squared per second, either in the visible or a bit brighter in the infrared, is okay. The angular resolution is starting to get tough because you're trying to find this object a few tenths of an arc second away from that object, which is a billion to a million times brighter than the object you're looking for. So TPF has a couple of different schemes we're studying, either an IR interferometer or a visible light chronograph. You know, look for Earth-sized planets in the, quote, habitable zone. Look for biosignatures, water, ozone, and so on. And very importantly, study the other constituents of planetary systems as well. And with this sensitivity, we can study the spectra of gas giant planets. You can look for evidence of comets and dust in these other solar systems. So in the visible, what does it take to do that? Well, even a simple chronograph on the Webb 6-meter telescope at 5 microns can look for Jupiters around the closest stars. But to do a really good job, you actually want to work more in the visible, where you've got more resolution. And something like a 2-meter system could do a lot of Jupiters. A 4-meter system could do not just Jupiters, but 30 to 50 stars looking for Earths. And if you really wanted to do a very broad survey for Earths, you need something like an 8 to 10 meter telescope. Let's see, so there's technology I won't talk about, but we're getting to the point where, at least in the lab, these dark areas in here, just off the side from this occulting bar, are getting down into the range of something like 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8th rejection factor, and that's starting to be the right scale. In the infrared, we're doing experiments on the nulling part of this, the IR nulling, and there we're getting starlight rejection between 10,000 and 100,000 to 1. Again, that's starting to get into the right range. Actually do this on the sky. The U of A guys have a nulling system going where they flip on the nuller, point source star disappears, flip on the nuller and a star with an envelope, you can actually start to pick up the envelope. So the idea of rejecting starlight is gaining at least some credibility. Briefly talking about life, the kinds of things that you think about on a surface of a planet. You get some life, it affects the atmosphere. What are the kinds of things you want to look for? Oxygen or its proxy ozone are probably the smoking guns for photosynthesis and life. You'd like to find water, CO2. Methane are all the sorts of gases that you'd like to be able to see. Preferably, you'd like to see these in some combination where they're outside of a normal equilibrium. So if you had methane and oxygen together, you know, that's really an indicator that something unusual is going on. And just more generally, you want to have a broad enough spectral coverage that you can see the unexpected things. So one of the things we've been arguing the last little while about TPF is we don't want just one mission, we want two. We actually want to work in the visible and in the infrared. And that's really the right combination. This gives you an idea, again, of just what gases you would see on a planet without life and with life. There's clearly much more richness and diversity of the different species in the atmosphere. And these all have lines either in the infrared or in the visible. In some cases, both. And there's a pretty good argument to be made that with both wavelength regions in hand, you get a lot better knowledge about the properties of the planets themselves in terms of albedo, radius, and temperature. You can solve uniquely for those. You know a lot more about the atmospheric properties. where you have lines at both the mid and near infrared for things like water and CO2, and you can actually, at least in one wavelength, have a good chance of seeing down at the surface if you have even at least a thin cloud cover. Most importantly, probably, is for life, if you can detect both ozone and oxygen in the mid-IR and in the visible, then you really have a very strong confirmation of the presence of life on the surface of such a planet. You can reject some of the false positives that you might get from, say, just having methane but not having some of the other species you'd expect for methane in the presence of life. And so we're arguing pretty strongly that you'd like to have both a mid-infrared and a visible version of TPF. You know, we'll see where it goes. There's a strong precursor science program that we've put in place for getting a lot of this precursor information that we want for the terrestrial planet finder. And Doug Lynn helped a lot with developing that. And the things that I've mentioned, estimating ages of Earth, understanding the structures in the zodiacal cloud, the evolution of zodiac clouds, these are all things of great interest to TPF, both scientifically and in some cases in engineering sense. So one should certainly try and take advantage of that. And then there's the question of, geez, does the nation really want to do something like Terrestrial Planet Finder? And the remarkable answer is yes. Among the goals that in the post-Columbia, in the post-Columbia vision, the goals that were set for NASA was not just do general astrophysics or something, or do X-ray astronomy. It was conduct advanced telescope searches for Earth-like planets and habitable environments around other stars. And it just doesn't get more explicit than that. So if you look at the NASA program, go to the moon, go to Mars, go to the outer moons, and then it doesn't say astrophysics, it says extrasolar planets. So here's Hubble, which clearly does our coronagraphic imaging. Kepler does transit, Spitzer does disks, SIM does astrometry, Webb does lots of things, but it'll also do stuff on disks. And then here's TPF. So I think there's a strong commitment both to the science of this sort of effort that really has in fact bubbled up from the scientific community over the last 5 to 10 years. And it's now been recognized as a science goal that NASA can really grab onto because it's exciting, you can explain it to people, and it is compelling. We do want to worry about all the other science you could do with something like TPF. So we've got Mark Kutchner holding a workshop in a couple of weeks where I hope some of you from here will contribute to that, where the central goal of TPF is obviously habitable planets and life. But outside that, we want to make sure that we do a good job on what I call comparative planetology, looking for giant planets and their properties, properties of disks, and then use TPF for other, you know, more standard astronomical things as resources permit. We are doing this jointly to the extent that we can with the Europeans. Their Darwin mission clearly has the better name. We'll adopt that if we can, maybe even some of their technology and money. And just end with the note that, as David said, this is really a very dynamic field at its infancy. And I think it's like cosmology. We're sort of at the stage when the cosmologists started out with the Mount Wilson 100 inch, where they didn't know a lot, they didn't even know what questions they really wanted to ask, and they just started observing. And it took them a long time to develop our view of cosmology that we now had through Hubble and eventually up through JWST, and then the cosmological background experiments have all given us a pretty good grasp of cosmology, and it's now become a really boring field for old people. And I think it's important that, you know, the people who are here really take advantage of the fact that you're getting in to this field of looking for planets sort of down at this stage over here. There's a lot of very exciting stuff to do. We have very remarkably ambitious long-term goals to actually find Earth-like planets with life on them. But there's going to be a lot of near-term and mid-term ways to detect planets and the nearest Earths and do a lot of very exciting astrophysics in the next couple of years. Thanks.
I'll take the check. Okay, we have a few minutes to ask some questions to chat. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, with regard to the TPF, you seem to be interested in trying to find oxygen and ozone. Mm-hmm. What are the contingencies for not finding life that's photosynthetic after all of them arise immediately on Earth? And you may not have, a planet to shroud in clouds, but photosynthesis may not work.
I think the way to think about it is either in the case of the visible light system or the mid-infrared system, the goal is to cover at least an octave of the spectrum. And within that octave, there's quite a lot of different species. I mean, so that the key ones that are broad and bright and Earth-like in a system that's even a little bit like Earth. You've got CO2 that shows up in all three of the terrestrial planets in our solar system. So you'd certainly look for that, and that could tell you a fair amount about, is there an atmosphere at all? What are the basic properties? You can look for water in both spectral regions, and water is, if not a biomarker, at least an indicator of Malibu-like places to possibly live. And then in terms of the actual signposts of life, if you don't have oxygen, then you could have methane.
That's an equilibrium
gas. Yeah, I mean, methane has problems associated with it, unless you see some oxygen or something. There's other things, there's nitrous oxide, there are a bunch of different ones. And at that point, you're going to say, well, here's the spectrum, and here's this weird line, I wonder what it's from. I mean, so as you start to depart from things that resemble the Earth, you're just going to have enough spectral capability to identify what some line is, and then go back and say, can I reproduce this in an abiotic way, or am I driven to, some interpretation that implies biology? I mean, oxygen is a pretty great case because it's hard to produce oxygen and have it stably in an atmosphere of a planet, so it's the best. What are the others? We'll have to go and see, but I think the goal is to design TPF so that it does have that spectral range. And the various astrobiology groups, Vicky Meadows, Jim Casting, Nick Wolfer, try to run all sorts of models where you put in different brands of life and see what you get.
Micro-lensing, I sort of wonder the actual value of such technique, because insofar as this problem is I'm not saying the whole thing is useless, but there's an application for planets that tend to be flyby events, rather far away. And, there's even the sample that's very well studied here, there is issues about metallicity, planet propensity correlation, which seems very delicate, very hard to understand. Can you take the same thing to a much more distant sample? And, you may find a few things. It's not an issue, we don't find planets. Planets exist.
Yeah, but so, I don't...
Understand. I mean, it's a thing to do, but it can't be really objectively a mainstream technique for this field at all.
Stan has a comment.
Can you speak a little louder?
The advantage of microlensing is... How many
what's the fraction of those star-spin systems that do have planets? And it does this very fast, very rapidly, much more rapidly than one can get, than one can do so with radial velocity, for example. And if GEST or something equivalent does fly, we will have, sound statistics certainly on the types of planetary systems that exist like our own, i.e. by detecting Jupiters at distances from their planets where they formed. And if you see you can then determine how many of those systems, statistically, how many of those systems exist, in a fractional sense. So microlensing, I think, has a very important role to play if it's adopted. But it, in fact, depends on that space mission going, because it cannot be done from the ground with any kind of a.
No, that doesn't add to Gaia.
So. Excuse me.
That doesn't add to Gaia. So that super Earth that thousands of Gaia.
Well, if it's I think Gaia does not detect Earths, which microlensing will.
That's for a near spot.
Yes, but your statistics are going to be very poor.
Okay, so is this a question about observation right now?
It was about the same time about Gaia.
Yep.
The microlensing is sensitive to long-term plants, whereas the mission is very velocity or starting, which is your mission lasts extremely long.
Gaia.
So, so there is a kind of difference that microlensing could potentially make.
Yeah, I think the microlensing case is, it's really unfortunate that transits are a really hard measurement on the right sort of stars, and the microlensing is a really easy measurement on the wrong sorts of stars. And you'd like to have something that combined the best of both.
I'm going to cut this one short.